I wanted to start out maybe just by asking a little bit about, I mean, because there was some chatter going on the side, but some of the maybe ecologically oriented work that Angie might have been doing recently, and something about that, just whatever you would like to say.
Well, like I said, I did this residency up in Point Reyes, like on the National Seashore, and I said a little bit about this when I was introducing that series that I read, but I was really fascinated to learn about ecological restoration models that account for thresholds. So I'm not sure if you remember this, but threshold indicators or threshold dynamics as kind of moments or points in a restoration process in which some factor changes the course of the restoration. And so it complicates modeling. Like basically you can't have a restoration model that's definitive in any way that says for sure, like this is what will happen if we do this. And so accounting for threshold dynamics in restoration ecology means that you have to be open to all of these different forms of contingency. And I just thought that was so interesting. And it has to do with a lot of different things. Like it becomes this kind of metaphor for all of the different ways that we relate to uncertainty in our lives and not just material uncertainties, but like relational uncertainties or other sorts of things. So that kind of metaphor of the restoration threshold dynamic was so interesting to me. But the wetlands that I was up near were the Jacquemini Wetland Project. It's just it had been pasture land for the latter half of the 20th century, as a lot of land up in the Point Reyes National Seashore has been. And then some of that land has been converted back to natural wetlands, sort of the state prior to when it was turned into pasture land for ranchers and whatnot in the 20th century. So it's kind of like part of that greater change happening up on the seashore to convert pasture lands. But not sure if that answers your question, but that's just some things that I was learning about when I was up there. So, yeah.
And I'm wondering how that whole notion of that discovery might feed into like poetic making and the idea of what we do with words.
Oh, that's a really good question. I think, yeah, when I was working on that series, I had the experience of kind of constellating different quotes and information and language in my own head. And then, so for example, there was this moment where I was thinking about a line of pelicans and how they resembled an overcast stitch in sewing. And then I started to like read about creating the overcast stitch and sewing. And then I kind of like went on this little tangent about that in the poem. And I think my process for this particular series has involved a lot of those sorts of like tangential trajectories. And I think that there's something about that process that feels true to this notion of threshold dynamics that I'm also trying to think about, like being open to contingency or the poem, the language going in a direction, the thinking of the poem going in a direction that you might not have anticipated. And so I'm trying to kind of be open to that, like the process evolving with alongside the concepts. But yeah, I think I imagine that you have something to say about this too, because the length, I feel like in the series that you read, there was so much language sort of forming and unforming around really abstract, but at the same time, like concrete materialities. And something about kind of the amorphousness of the materials and the amorphousness of language, like I was thinking about that. I'm not sure. I'm punting the question to you or just a comment.
Was there a question or?
I guess the question would be, well, one question I actually do have for you about the series that you read is what, like, where does the language come from?
Sure.
Was it in any way generated, or was it just language that you were sort of creating based on things you were reading?
Well, the name of the book is Origin, and it actually started with, I'm going to talk to you, but also to them. It's actually started with Origin of the Species of Mr. Darwin, only because I've always been like super fascinated at that point in human history where it kind of seems like everything just was ruined, like that sort of mid-1800s where it's, you know, just like everything just seemed kind of terrible at that moment. The Industrial Revolution coming and like the slave trade and that like just like everything that seems like kind of terrible seemed to all be happening in that moment, and Charles Darwin is happening in that moment. So I started reading that and was interested in that, and then sort of trying to find my way through like the present moment in this past text. So the second section that I read tonight was actually the first section that was written, and came, a lot of the animals and some and that stuff is all pulled from from him. But then like concurrent to that, like obsessive thinking about that moment in history is also the kind of current present reality of being embodied in this female form and the ways in which the sort of like what was happening in my community was a lot of conversation about sort of like the our community of you know, just sort of the ways in which you can be a female poet, and like a lot of people were kind of talking a lot about the various atrocities of that women poets were dealing with, but from, you know, like just blatant random misogyny to like sexual assault, and really spending a lot of time thinking about that in my own history and my own community. And so those things kind of like mush together about like what sort of like the ecological atrophy of like individual personhood as well as like whatever. I said it came from the source, but then it's also like most of the book, unlike other books that I've done, it's mostly I wrote it.
Okay.
Whatever.
Yeah.
But there's
that was one reason I asked, because I know that you have worked with procedures, and you know, so it seemed like maybe some of the language was coming from other places, but at the same time, it, you know,
Right.
Yeah.
I think at one point I looked at, what is that Charlton Heston movie? I'm looking at Steve because you would probably remember, where they're like zombies. They're Charlton Heston. And he's like walking around. Does anyone have like film?
It's not fun.
No.
Dawn of the Dead.
Huh? Dawn of the Dead. No, that's later. Anyway, there's like a movie that was, I can't remember the name of it right now. Sorry. Do you know?
Omega Man.
Was super formative to me as a child. do you guys know that movie? I mean, it's ridiculous, but there was a moment in that, in my writing it, where I was watching that movie and translating it, basically. I think there's something about having a weapon in hand. I think it's Charlton Heston, like, running. The movie's great, you should watch it. Poor Charlton Heston.
I guess for both of you. So at the last reading that we attended last Thursday, somebody asked, like, as far as the writing process goes, like, how many hours a day do you put into your writing? Or, like, is it just sporadically, like, when you have this, like, moment of clarity? Or, you know, do you sit down at your desk and, you know, be like, I'm going to work for 2 hours? Or is it just you experience something and you have to jot it down and then go back to it later? I would just like to hear kind of, like, the process of, that you go through.
Sure.
Do you want
the idea of like a muse or whatever is like hilarious. It's just that concept is hilarious to me, and it's always been hilarious to me. Like, it feels like a, I don't know, like a purple thing. I don't know. It's just, that has not ever been, what?
Lucky you.
I know. No, that is not, that doesn't make any sense to me. I'm like primary caregiver to my child, and I have a job, and I'm also a person for whom, unfortunately, external deadlines are an important factor in getting anything done. So no, I don't have that, like, I wish so hardly, and that's not a word, but I really wish that I was the person that could be like, oh my God, I just had the brilliantest idea. Like, you know, swipe the world away. Or, oh my gosh, it's 5 a.m. I'm getting up and I'm gonna, you know, do like Surya Namaskar and then write for 2 hours. You know, I like, in my dream world, that's who I am, but that's not who I am. So External deadlines work really well for me. So if, you know, like I have a reading coming up or somebody asks me for something, which rarely happens in real life, but sometimes happens, then I'll write. But I did this genius thing, which I would, and I'm going to say it's genius because it is, which I would recommend to you wholeheartedly. Please take this idea. I do an annual DIY residency with some friends who I love. And we rent a house super cheap, and we leave our life behind, and we don't apply for this residency. We just go, you know, we like find a house that we can afford, and we all stay and make food together and go to our separate spaces and then come together. And I'm very lucky to have a group of friends that I love that we can do that. And it feels extraordinary. We're all women, and it feels extraordinary to like have a sense of like we're all making something, but it's all separate, and it's really great. So that happens once a year. And then if I have, like, if somebody asks me for something, I'm a bad writer in the, like, classic irony sense.
DIY residency, that's such a good idea.
Right?
Yeah.
You steal that idea.
Yeah. I'm going to steal that idea. I'm not a very prolific poet. It takes me a long time to get into a new project. But then when I do, I write these serial poems, I write sort of long poems, and so then I'll just kind of like go with it. You know, like I've been really immersed in this writing that I presented tonight, you know, but that's not usual. You know, sometimes it takes a long time to get to a point where I feel like I'm kind of entering into a new project. To get there, I just like read a lot, you know, like I was quoting Sarah Ahmed tonight. She has this beautiful book called The Promise of Happiness, which is basically just about how nobody's ever going to be happy. And happiness is just sort of this heterocentric ideology that gets projected onto all of us, whether you're, you know, gay or straight or queer or whatever. So, yeah, it's really, I've really been like needing a book about the impossibility of happiness lately. So anyway, you know, just sort of reading things can like really get you thinking and can help you generate questions that become poems. And for me, something that's also generative is like approaching my poems from different places. So like maybe the privacy of a residency, a kind of protected space, or maybe like, you know, the kind of chaos of the morning commute. I take a train to work. I take the Amtrak train to my work in Davis. And so sometimes, I guess it's not too chaotic, but just, you know, coming at the work from the kind of mundane daily perspective, or, you know, altered states are always good. You should always read your poetry in an altered state before you send it out for publication or something, because it might help you see something that you wouldn't have been able to see otherwise. But you know, just basically, I'm sorry. You know, just looking at your work from different angles, from different places, and different states of mind. You know, just in addition to like sharing it with trusted friends or readers or whatever. But I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. So I kind of want to know, like, what's your early struggles of getting published, of being a poet, and if through that, can you like give us like one tip too?
I came to writing, I guess, relatively late. Like I didn't write a book until I was in my 30s, I guess. So I don't have that kind of like, I've always been a writer and I've been like scrabbling away. So I was extraordinarily lucky to know of a press my friend had published in. We had similar aesthetic concerns. She was like, I think he would like your book. And I was like, hey, you published my friend, you know. Which sounds like not helpful advice, but I actually think it is helpful in that it's really important to read books that you love and find out who the publisher is of them and see if your work is resonating with, I'm assuming you're reading books that echo kind of your own work in some way. Like you're gonna read books that you care about, then you're gonna write those books kind of similarly. Like find out who those publishers are and then build a relationship with their catalog. And then when you have an opportunity to send them work, like you're having a conversation with their work, and you can even say in your cover letter, like, hey, I read, you know, these books that you've made in the world mean so much to me, and, you know, I wrote this book, and I, you know, hope that it's interesting to you. And I do think, I mean, that's if you have a finished, like, thing that's not like a magazine, but it's similar if you have, like, one piece versus a whole series of things. I think having, as poetry is like, you know, you, it's like a no money, no prestige, no end game kind of society, because the end game is really about making the work, at least it is for me, and I feel like the community in which I reside, it's like the conversation is the interesting part, and so throw yourself in that conversation, and I feel like I've been really lucky to have the books that I've made be in the world, because I'm doing all of this, I'm interested in talking about whatever it is that's happening that's talking about it, and then my work is reflecting that. So as like just advice, I would say get to know who you want to be in company with and then be part of that company. Does that make sense? Okay.
Well, I was kind of one of those kids who like always wanted to get a book published. Like when I was in second grade, I was like, Mom, I want to get a book published, you know, like how can, and I was writing stories at the time. So when I was in college, I had like written quite a bit of poetry. At that point, I was writing poetry, and I remember I am from St. Paul, Minnesota, and I called Grey Wolf Press. Do you know Grey Wolf Press? They published like Claudia Rankine's latest book. They're a literary small press, but they're not really a small press. They're sort of more of a mid-sized press. Good publisher. There was no way they were going to publish my book. So I called them, and I was like, I have these poems that I want to see published as a book, like, you know, what should I do? You know, and probably, I don't know who I was talking to on the phone, and they were just like, you know, well, you got to send them out to journals, and you got to, you know, maybe you should come do an internship for us. So I ended up doing this internship. It was unpaid, but it was a great internship just to learn about small press literary publishing. You know, and from there, I kind of, like, continued to immerse myself in small press publishing and, like, the poetry world, and then I came here to do my MFA at St. Mary's College, San Francisco Bay Area. So, and I think that you are really lucky because you're in the Bay Area, and it's such a place for poetry. Like there's so and other, you know, literary genres as well. Like there's so much publishing happening, and there's so many writers everywhere, and you have these events all the time. So, you know, I think like Samantha was saying, like just embrace the conversation. And I think that especially in a place like the Bay Area, one of the best things you can do to find a publisher is just like go to events and meet people and learn about what people are publishing. And before you know it, you might have an internship, or you might have an editor who was willing to read your work, or a co-publisher, yeah. Someone who you could make books with, or just cool people who you can talk to about writing and the writer's life. You know, so just like get out. You know, don't be recluse.
So I was kind of curious because you were talking about like environmental issues, and I was thinking like, do you think like environmental issues can be connected with racism, as far as like I want to say like depending on like where you live, like certain neighborhoods are like crowded with liquor stores or gas stations or that type of situation. So I was thinking like, could that kind of like be connected to any of your writing?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I'm also a literary scholar, and I do a lot of writing on environmental justice literatures. And the great insight of environmental justice as a movement within environmentalism more broadly is that it says, you know, environmental risk and hazard is not equally sort of dispersed, distributed, and that certain populations, women, people of color, people with disabilities, suffer greater environmental risks, bear a greater brunt of the environmental risk. And then environmental justice as an environmental movement goes on to articulate the ways in which this is so. And so I'm personally just like fascinated with literatures on environmental justice and poets who do this work to articulate these things. A poet I've done a lot of work on more recently is Audre Lorde, who died of cancer in 1992. And she believed,
she had breast cancer, and later it metastasized, and she ended up dying of liver cancer. But she believed that cancer was a political weapon against Black women. She believed that what she called the profit economy, in other words, capitalism, and the state were, like, you know, wielding cancer as a kind of weapon against, you know, in order to further disenfranchise Black women specifically. And that had everything to do with where people were living and the industrial chemicals to which they were subject and exposed. And she knew that intimately from living most of her life in New York City and being oftentimes, like, sort of on the margins, on the edges of different industrial landscapes. And so I think that, you know, poets and many different writers, but poets are doing a lot of work to articulate the way in which people of color and women and queers and people with disabilities, like, bear a great burden of environmental risk, like, given, you know, the kind of greater scope of how that happens. So I don't know if that, I mean, I could give you, like, I could just tell you people that I read and love, and I'm sure you have recommendations for me too. You know, it's like, I think a lot of great work being done. I mean, you could read Claudia Rankine's book, Citizen, as a kind of environmental justice project. She has a script in that book about Katrina, and just about all of the different bodies, and in particular Black bodies, that were subject to violence during and in the wake of that storm. And it's basically a work of environmental literature, you know, arguably. I mean, Mae Bersenbrugge is a wonderful poet who wrote her book 4-Year-Old Girl, I believe, kind of in the aftermath of her own exposure to pesticides. She, you know, had lived in proximity to pesticides and was suffering a lot of environmental illness as a result, and that gets into her work.
I would also just say, like, as a the thing that I think is really great about poetry is that it has such a generosity to make kind of any leap that you want. So even if, like, you're, as a writer, if your connections, perhaps, like, you know, Claudia Rankine is making this kind of leap between Katrina and sort of, like, the state of Blackness in America, but, like, your leap might include, like, liquor stores and, you know, like, being a child and playing in the, I don't know what your biology is, or, I mean, your biography, but any kind of leap is possible. And then I think the magic of poetry is, like, allowing this kind of, like, disjuncted in other genres or other forms might seem like, can I really make that, you know, like, am I allowed to put these two things together? Like, in poetry, the answer is astoundingly and overwhelmingly yes. So even if it feels like, I wouldn't write this as, like, a piece of journalism or whatever, like, in poetry, that's possible because you can use the magic of poetry. I don't know. That makes sense.
Samantha, I was just thinking a lot about the weight of the personal pronoun you in selection, and I was just wondering if you could talk about what was behind that for you, what that allowed you to do, and how that was operating.
Thank you. So my second book, Dead Falls and Snares, which Steve wrote, read that thing from C.I. Conrad, which when I first got it made me cry. So every time I hear it out loud, I'm like, oh, there's that thing. That book negotiated all the pronouns, and Elise was actually part of helping make that happen. We were in kind of like a workshop-y situation together, and she was part of a group of people who were like, oh, I see an I and I see a you, and where's the we? And I put a we in that book. So there was a way in which pronoun, like, I was already kind of like thinking about the ways in which a pronoun, you know, as a reader, you read it in your head, and as a like orating it, you say it, and like to whom it's addressing. And I think, I don't know that I 100% know the answer in this book, but I do know that there's a way in which it's always been tricky for me to, and I'm not a poetry scholar, so I'm gonna get the wrong like term. It's the using the I is tricky for me, like having work that's like, I'm talking about I, me, Samantha, like that place has always felt unattractive to me. So there's a way in which the you, like, even though there's parts of this book that I'm actually like saying something, which is really hard to tell, obviously, because I've covered it up in mud and frogs and stuff. But there are things that I'm saying in there that are very like personal to me. And there's a way, like, it's almost, I'm embarrassed to say, like, it's a little bit of a like, no, it's you or whatever. But I also think there's a way in which that I'm attacking things that are, I'm attempting to attack and perhaps failing to always negotiate like sort of like complicity in people, in the reader and in myself and in like the larger community. And I think there's a way in which like a you can function as an accusatory and like an, both an invitation and an accusation. And I like that it's muddled in that way. I like that, I don't know, I like that direct, I like that pronoun. I like that it's both centered in like, and it can be read as an I, because I think, you know, lots of people use the you as an effective way to say, I'm doing this, you know, it's like the voice of God or something like that. Yeah, I don't know if I answered your question. I don't know, it's a messy answer for me. I don't know that I have like, oh, I'm so glad you asked that. Let me go to page 374 of my, you know, theses on what I'm doing. It's messy for me. And I feel like there's a way in which reading that work out loud and saying you so much bothers me. Like, I'm like, oh, I wish there wasn't so much you in here, but I it's too late to change it. It's an imperfect process. Yeah. Do you have thoughts about it?
Well, I just really felt that doubleness of the, like, the accusation in it, but also that the slipperiness, that feeling as it was me, or that there, sometimes it felt like there really was a specific you. And when you were talking about Darwin, I was wondering, oh, you know, is that part of a conversation with him, or just the, I was just interested in the way that it moved and it affected me at different times listening. So I was just curious about how that was operating, even as a composing device, just the repetition of it and the different iterations.
I mean, my hope is that it's not a staple you.
No.
So, yay, I won. Yeah, I don't want it to be like the same. Yeah. Thanks.
You and you have both been very generous, and we have run out of time. So unless somebody has a very quick question, I think we're finished.
Oh, there's a quick question.
A quick question, wonderful.
A question that may take a long time for you to answer?
No, I don't think it will. My question is on your revision process, and this is for both of you. I'm also a poet, and I tend to revise as I write, and then I, like, never look at the poem again until I have to read it out loud. And I just want to know what your process is and whom you share your poems with.
I revise quite obsessively, like, up until the very last minute. And really, I didn't stop revising the material that went into this book until it was like time to sign off on it and send it to the press. You know, I just, and a lot of it has to do with the form. I think that the poems are serial poems, and so they're like fragmenty and processual, and it just, you know, they kind of invite a constant attention and reattention or whatnot. So I don't know. I'm kind of an obsessive reviser. And I also don't write poetry in a linear way, like beginning, middle, and end. I'll kind of like enter at different points and at different places, and also revise that way. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting to hear people talk about their revision processes, because everybody's is so different, you know. And but it feels like writing. Revision feels like writing in and of it, you know, of itself.
I feel really differently about the work in the various ways it is performed. So it feels like a performance to write it. It feels like a performance on the page. It feels like a performance to read it out loud. And like at various, like in each of those stages, like different, like, oh, that's weird, or that doesn't feel, like it's all just like, it feels right or it doesn't feel right. So I'll, you know, like mess with the kerning or whatever, or I've gotten like more as I've written more, the physical space feels less important to me in a weird way, which is surprising. You know, if I told myself 10 years ago that I wouldn't kern things, I would be like, what?
Is that the
where
space?
Where you make the space?
The
yeah, like I just thought that was the most awesome thing.
I love
when
that
I was
messing with kerning is, yeah. is like a key component of your revision process.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, I was like, that word needs to be stretched more. Reading stuff out loud visual. Is really, really like the crux of where I feel like I revise, because it's if it sounds weird, or I did for Deadfalls, I went through like where things were on the page, and I read from that book a lot before it became a book, and I changed stuff the way that it looked on the page from the way that I had said it out loud. Like certain things got italicized or moved down because of how I just naturally read them. But I similarly, like the book that I read from tonight, my publisher was like, made me sign a piece of paper, like as a joke, that was like, no more, she's my friend, but she was like, not, shut it down, like you can't change another word, I'm sending it to the designer, because I was like, well, what did you do with, can I just, I mean, it always feels like imperfect and not done, which is good, it's like a baby, you know, yeah.
Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.